My name is Jane Smith, and I'm Will Catlin's great great granddaughter.
My name is Margot, and I'm Will Catlin's youngest daughter and only surviving daughter.
I tend to do quite a bit of family history, and my understanding of just the knowledge of his childhood, being born in Leicester in 1871. He was apprenticed to be a tailor's cutter, but he wasn't really cut out for that, he decided. So he decided to take to the boards and started performing on the stage in and around Leicester initially.
As far as I'm led to believe, at one stage when he was a young boy, very young man, he ran away from home to the Isle of Man, where he supposedly established some form of a group, performing group. But I would imagine it would be alfresco, because if he left home with pretty well nothing, probably was busking around at the time.
I suppose it was the start of the Industrial Revolution and people going to sort of the seaside towns for holidays and things, and he thought that would be good audiences for him, and Scarborough was presumably quite a popular resort. I suppose it wasn't all that close to Leicester, so I don't know what else sort of took him there.
My father always used to say they all had to do everything. They all had to sing, they all had to dance, they all had to act, they all had to play an instrument, and they had to be interchangeable. I do know from him personally. I think they were called banjos in those days. They call them ukuleles now more, but they were banjos. That's the only one I know, because we always had one in our house that my father used to strum occasionally. He used to play the piano. He used to vamp. He was a good vamper. And he used to compose the opening numbers for the shows, which were happy songs, pleased to see you, and then at the end, hope you've had a nice time sort of thing. I know it was very family orientated, because my father would never, ever have any smut of any sort, so.
I think he had two sisters and maybe about five brothers.
Yeah, it was a very large family, wasn't it? Mm. Where did he come in the pecking order? Was he the last?
He was up towards the top, I think.
Oh, was he?
I think so. Tom was younger than him. But again, I haven't brought that info.
No.
I can't remember things very well these days.
You're better than I am.
Should have done a bit better swatting up before I came, shouldn't I? I mean, lots of his sisters would have been sort of tailor's cutters, and I know there are stories that his sisters and subsequently his daughters were involved in making the costumes, cutting the costumes out on the dining room
table.
He used
to make them himself as well.
Yeah, yeah.
When he left school, he was apprenticed to a tailor long before any of this happened, and so consequently he had the knowledge and the skill to make costumes, which he did. For his troop. Baggy pyjamas, white, with a big ruff round the neck, black and white usually, big black pom-poms down the front, and a conical black and white hat. It wasn't a clown's makeup. It was just slightly exaggerated eyes and lips, but it certainly wasn't a clown's makeup. They used to walk round the town in their costumes to advertise the show, and they used to go to the train station to meet people coming in to advertise the show. He was a great showman, my father, and he knew a lot about advertising. But he was very particular about their behaviour. They were all single men, and they were not allowed to be seen out with a lady, because their attraction was that they were eligible.
And as he got more successful and earned more money, then he started developing separate troops to go out. I know that he found it very difficult to be recruiting people just on a seasonal basis, so that's when he started to go inland and performing inland during the winter months so he could provide all-year employment for the boys in the troop. Although then he did obviously deploy different managers to manage the different troops. Some of those were his brother, Tom Fox. And I think actually his son-in-law as well, Harry Scrimmage, he provided employment for a lot of his immediate brothers and sisters and also son-in-laws. Because Wyn Calvin did, I don't know if it was an interview.
Well, I've got that tape because I was on it.
Oh, have you?
My
I've
mother
got the
and
script.
I.
I've got the transcript of the tape that's been
have you?
I've got
down.
The tape. Yes, my mother was on it and I was on it and various people.
Oh, right.
And Wyn Calvin did the interlocutory matter, which is very good. He was very good.
Mm. He's still alive.
Is he still alive?
Is he? Mm-hmm.
He was here for many years as the chief comedian, Wyn. And he made this tribute to my father, which was very good.
Mm. Well, I've got the text for that, but I haven't got the recording. Because my father was very interested in researching the Catlin history, so I inherited quite a few bits and pieces.
I'll tell you one thing, when he was doing Pierrot's in Scarborough, an opposition troop was going to do something amazing, I don't know what it was, and my father organised a diversion which involved jumping off a cliff with wings on, not him personally, but he organised it so people would come and see this spectacle rather than going to see the, you know, it was Dirty Tricks campaign, definitely. You know, you do it one better than them and the audience will come to you. Well, he was such a showman and he was such a good businessman, he was such a publicist. Nobody would know it better than him, and they were his troops. So he took control and he laid the law down, what they could and couldn't do, like not going out with ladies and such like. Lots of names, the governor, the boss. They referred to him with great affection, I might say. He could rule with a rod of iron if need be, but he wasn't a hard man at all. He was a very fair man. And he was very much loved by his artists.
A story in our family goes that Will Catlin used to go off to do his Pierrot shows in Scarborough, and his wife or his mother or whoever said, "Shall I make you a sandwich?" And he used to say, "I don't earn enough money to buy myself some lunch, and I won't have any." In Scarborough, one of the reasons he decided to buy the Arcadia, which he bought from the Kilralfie brothers, was the fact that the council, they were so successful that they put up their rents extortionately. So he decided that that was the time for him to buy
his own place. I've just read that recently, actually, funnily enough.
And that's how he moved off the stand, really, sort of into the Arcadia. That's my understanding of it.
I remember it well. He was a well-known figure standing outside the Arcadia of an evening with his cigar, welcoming the patrons. He always welcomed the patrons in. He was there every night. It's just a personal touch, which, again, he knew was, you know, worth a lot. And he'd stand there with his cigar, and that was his preference. He liked a nip of whiskey, but he wasn't a drinker by any means. And when people used to come and see him, friends, famous people, whatever, and they'd all go in the bar. My father had an agreement with the barman that they would serve him something underneath, like Coca-Cola, which looked like whiskey, because he wasn't going to sit and drink, because he needed his faculties. You know, when he did the Catlin Follies in the Arcadia, he always had a minstrel, either opening or closing. Closing the first half or opening the second half. Always. Blacked up. For many, many years he did that, but of course then it became politically incorrect.
Again, I think from memory, he was operating from the Arcadia and he just built Kingscliff Holiday Camp behind the Arcadia, which was a big Butlins type sort of holiday
camp.
Yes,
he went into
all
the holiday
tents,
camp business.
Yeah, all tents and things.
But I've still got some of the cutlery.
Oh, have you?
With the name on it.
Oh, have you?
Yes, they all had Catlin on the handle. It's about then that he gets together with my mother, who was his secretary, and was 30 years younger. So you can see why it was not talked about, because it was something, you know, it was swept under the carpet. Mm.
We've got some Queen's Hotel, because he owned the Queen's Hotel in Scarborough as well. I think it was bombed, and I think it wasn't one of his opening nights at the same time as the Battle of Jutland, and I think the offices in Scarborough were bombed, so that was a little bit of a setback to him, but obviously it didn't set him back for very long.
Well, again, rumour has it, Jane, that he made his fortune and then lost it all.
Was it?
And then made another one.
In Llandudno? Or in Scarborough?
So subsequently he made them. I mean, I don't know the dates of anything of this, you see, but he had the theatre and he had the holiday camp and all sorts. And then everything went crashing down. It might have been because of the war. Mm. First of all, he retired from Scarborough. He retired and went to live in Reading. He built a house in Reading. And him and my mother went to live there. And I think it was to get away from the heat, personally, of Scarborough and start again. And then he used to come up here during the summer, putting on shows here. And this was then just about the breakout of the war, just after the breakout of the war, I think. And we came up here for a holiday and we never went back. And then he came out of retirement and started concentrating on Llandudno. And that's when he started, that I know of, to do the concert party, because that's my first recollections. Mm. Oh, I'm sure he liked his work, because he retired and was bored stiff. And then he started again. At the age of 60-odd, he started again. My father was very much of the present and the future. The past was gone, and we didn't discuss it. Mainly, I think, because he had this guilty secret, which my sister and I were ignorant of. I didn't learn of this until
My mother was on her deathbed, and she was suddenly taken with remorse that I would find out when I went through her possessions, and particularly her deed box, which she kept in the bank with all her private memorabilia in. So she confessed to me, literally on her deathbed, that she and my father had not been married. Now, we're going back nearly 100 years. It was very taboo. And my father's first wife was a Catholic and would not divorce him. So when they split, he met my mother, and he changed her name by deed poll to Catelyn, and she became Mrs. Catelyn. But she never was until shortly before his death, they went secretly to Carnarvon and got married. So consequently, his past was never mentioned in front of the children. That is sad, but in those days, you didn't talk about things like that. It just wasn't, it was totally taboo.